And the Psalms of Ascents were basically the songs that the Jewish people would use throughout their history as they journeyed upward towards Jerusalem to their festivals. Three times a year, the Jewish culture as an entire nation would take this journey towards Jerusalem, spring, summer, and fall, basically to have this massive party / family reunion and festival, young and old, to sacrifice and to worship and adore their God. So it was a huge deal. They anticipated them, and these songs were the songs that they sang on their journey. So it's kind of like this English pub on a road trip sort of feel, like, you know, they have these going. And when I say upward towards Jerusalem, I literally mean up, because Jerusalem is the highest point in Israel. So no matter where you lived, 5 miles away or 50 miles away, you had to walk uphill to get there. So it was not an easy trip. Mountains, you know, rocks. Imagine yourself, probably sandals on, inclement weather, maybe rainy, kids in tow, sometimes behave, sometimes not. You've got things going on in your group, your clan gets bigger as you go along. And then, you know, everything's going well. You feel this sense of exhilaration. All of a sudden, you know, your three-year-old drops a load in his pants. And so, you know, you were feeling good about it. Then you got to stop. Everybody's got to stop. It's like, oh, man. And then somebody lights into a song, one of these songs of ascents, and at first you're like, shut the song, you know, like, but then something in your heart begins to turn and realize the purpose of why you're on this trip, why you're on this journey, and something awakens in your heart, and so you get back on the road. Well, that's what I want us to do today. We are going to sing all Bridgeway songs. The songs we're going to sing are songs that come from the core of our community. Just like they had psalms, these are all songs that we're going to sing today that have been written by people in this community. And some you'll be familiar with and some you won't. But they have shaped the history of our community. They have embodied our values. They have given us place and permission to be affectionate with God, no matter the place that we're in. And the songs that we sing, like for Israel, the songs today, you'll notice, will have a communifying effect. Music just opens the heart. And so we want to give ourselves to this. Specifically, there are three themes in these psalms. There are lots of themes, but there are three dominant themes. The first theme is that of afflictions, remembering God in and through our afflictions. And Josh Bottomley is a house church pastor in our community, is going to lead us through that movement. And the second movement, Andy Biddy, who is also a house church pastor, is going to lead us through, and that's on faith. And then lastly, Joel will lead us through a movement of celebration and victory. And we're going to read these psalms together and take the material of the scriptures and allow them to help us to turn our hearts towards God and worship, no matter the place that we're in. America and even Bridgeway, we tend to be a pretty individualistic church, but I'm asking you to intentionally unify yourself with the people here in heart and in mind and in worship. We're going to culminate our day together in communion, celebrating the Lord's Supper and what he's done for us in his death and his resurrection. But essentially, we're going to go on a journey together today to the throne room of God, like they went on a journey years and years and years ago towards the throne room of God, and the anticipation that was brought by doing that. So we're going to allow ourselves kind of the progression of through these movements. And here's one thing I want to encourage you to do physically that may help you embody the journey mindset. I'm going to pray for us, and then Josh is going to come up and lead us through the first movement. But as I pray, I would encourage you, if you're sort of on an island or you're away from people in your row in your particular section, I'm going to encourage you to get up and slide over and avoid the movie theater one seat in between thing and actually get next to the people in your row. And watch what this does. There's something powerful even allowing our spirits, our hearts to actually connect physically. Okay? So if you can do that in your individual sections, I'm going to pray for us. Josh, you can come on up. Father, we are here for you.
So where do we begin? It's interesting. We don't begin in the garden, which is what as Protestants we often do. Begin in the place of paradise, kind of like Disneyland, where the streets are clean and everybody's walking around with balloons in their hands and lollipops in their mouth, and it's a small world after all blaring over the speakers. John said that we're an individualistic church in America, and maybe the Jews would look at us and go, maybe you're a little too enthusiastic. See, the Jews, they don't begin in the garden, in the place of paradise. They begin, to borrow from Steinbeck, east of Eden, in the place of suffering. For them, they begin in Egypt. For this was their metaphor that represented a distillation of all of their suffering and affliction, their sense of displacement and exile. See, before they understood that they were a people of the light, they understood that they lived in a world of darkness. I want to read to you an excerpt from my favorite author, Frederick Buechner, from Listening to Your Life, and he writes about darkness in the world. In one respect, if in no other, the metaphor of darkness is a very relevant one for us in our age, because we are also, God knows, a people who walk in darkness. There seems little need to explain. If darkness is meant to suggest a world where nobody can see very well, either themselves or each other, or where they are heading, or even where they are standing at the moment, if darkness is meant to convey a sense of uncertainty, of being lost, of being afraid, if darkness suggests conflict, conflict between races, between nations, between individuals, each pretty much out for himself when you come right down to it, then we live in a world that knows much about darkness. Darkness is what our newspapers are about. Darkness is what our best contemporary literature is about. Darkness fills the skies over our own towns and cities no less than over the towns and cities of our enemies. And in our single lives, we know much about darkness too. As if we are a people who pray, darkness is apt to be a lot of what our prayers are about. And if we are a people who do not pray, it is apt to be darkness in one form or another that has stopped our mouths. The first psalm we're going to read, Psalm 123, I would argue is this psalmist's attempt to help keep the Israelites' mouths open, to prevent them from letting the despair shut it. What we're going to find is that this psalmist, they form their words around truths that help them engage the darkness and fight for that very thing that they struggle to hold on to, the truth. And it's interesting because what they understand is that the way that we fight for the truth is we tell the truth as we feel it, as a way of fighting for it, as in our heart of hearts we know it. In other words, we communicate to God what's in our hearts, not what ought to be in our hearts. I want to invite you to stand with me right now. We're going to read this together out loud. I want you to listen for the truth as this psalmist feels it. Psalm 123, read it with me. I look to you, heaven-dwelling God, look up to you for help, like servants alert to their master's commands. Like a maiden attending her lady, we're watching and waiting, holding our breath, awaiting your word of mercy. Mercy, God, mercy. We've been kicked around long enough, kicked in the teeth by complacent rich men, kicked when we were down by arrogant brutes. You can be seated. King Geyer, who's a prolific writer and a personal friend, he once told me when I was attempting to become a writer myself, he said, Josh, a good writer seeks to do one thing, one courageous thing, and that is simply to open a vein. What I think Kent meant by that is that what it means to open a vein is to seek to tell the truth. These psalmists are truth tellers. They write in their blood. They write in their humanity more than their spirituality. But then again, they weren't separate. They were one. Bono calls all the great psalmists the first great blues singers. I find that interesting, because the blues are all about telling the truth. Because if you read someone like David, I don't think David would ever be able to pastor a church because he was way too raw and he was way too gritty. He was too out there. You read his psalms and psalmists like these and they crying out, God, where are you? They cry out their questions until their esophaguses burn with pain. So here are the Israelites, beginning at the bottom, where the physical topography reminds them of their spiritual topography. And they are literally becoming, as they sing these psalms, they're becoming blues travelers. Catchy, I know. Blues travelers together. And here's what's going on that's so cool, is that as they shape their mouths around these words, it helps them crawl down into their hearts. And as they do that, they're not only moving downward, but they're also moving outward into each other as a community, and they're moving upward into God. I ran into Lance at Starbucks about a year ago, and he said, Josh, how's your house church going? And I sat down, I said, it's been going pretty well, Lance, but you know what? We are still people who are so opaque. Big English word. I'm an English teacher. Humor me, okay? I told him, you know, we're still so incredibly guarded as people. We've been meeting for 2 or 3 years, and we still have these walls of thickness that we can't penetrate together. We still feel real comfortable talking about OU and OSU basketball and football and talking about where we went shopping and what reality shows we're watching and what's going on in our kids' life. And then when we sit down with the Bible, we just kind of squirm around together, you know? We just don't know how to do this. And it's because largely we've been taught when it comes to dealing with God really and being truthful, we're really taught just to stuff it. Don't ask your questions. Just believe with faith. We don't know how to live our questions together. We really don't know how to do this. And I ache for it. There's been some interesting things that God's done in our community as a house church, and that God has provided us moments where we've been able to move into each other like never before. Many of you know Brandon and Sherry, and you know that their twins' lives for about 7 months were hanging in the balance, and Sherry was bedridden, and for 7 months or so, you know, we just kind of lived in that suspended state with them where we didn't know whether they were going to live or die. And we just would be with them in that space of suspension. Abe and Gina are part of our community, and Abe's father, I think, had a stroke or a heart attack, and we went up and we prayed with them, and we cried out for God to heal him, and he passed away. And there were a lot of questions and prayers that seemed to go unanswered. So what do we do with that? just be in the pain with them. And here's what I found that would happen, and maybe it's happened in your community too, is that suffering at moments has had the power to transform us from people of opacity into people of transparency. We come to a point where we're like, I want you to look into my heart, and I want you, if you have the courage, to crawl down into my heart and just be there with me in my pain, with my questions. Here's a simple but hard truth that I've learned, is that nothing makes a greater inroad into the human heart like pain. I want you to close your eyes as I read this to you. Before we can move upward towards celebration, we must move downward and inward into lamentation. We must understand that community is often consummated with laughter, rejoicing, and dancing, but community is often created through the ashy haze of tears and snot and groaning. This is where true community is born. And this is where we go from being a people who know what they believe to being a people who love because they belong. From believing to belonging. And oh, how the world aches for belongingness. And as the people of God, this is what we offer to them. Our suffering becomes a revelation to the world of our belongingness to each other and to God. Open your eyes. I want to open a vein real shortly with you from my own life. My wife and I, we've been trying to have a baby for 2 years. And we've not been able to. And it's made real hard to be here at Bridgeway because there's been like an explosion of babies everywhere here. And we're excited about that. But at the same time, it just kicks us in the teeth. You know. And here's what it's forced me to deal with, and that is it's had me deal with some of the illusions that the culture has created, specifically the illusion that I am this rugged individual. I am this, borrow the Latin, homo autonomous. I am a law and a creature unto myself. I am self-created. I am self-sustained. I am self-determined. I am the sum total of my choices. We are bombarded with this message every day. And it is a lie of the devil. It's really the American dream to do life my way, how I want to do it. We are a culture that worships the will. Here's what God's teaching me. Josh, you are not homo autonomous. You are homo communitas, which means you are a communal being. Because if God is a dynamic and loving community, and I am created in the imago Dei, the image of God, then that means that I was created to be in relationship with others. There have been moments in my life where I've just gotten with my friends. I've said to Brad Kilman and to Matt Palmer and to my friend Josh Banner, would you just be in my pain with me? Would you crawl into my heart? And you're going to see some scary things in there. You're going to learn that I don't know what's going on. I teach at Cassidy where we kind of celebrate what we know, and I don't know anything, really. Don't tell anybody. I lose my job. You know, I lift weights, and I try to look strong and cool and tough and like to be a jock and like to talk about what it was like when I played basketball, but truth is, man, I'm 9/10 a chicken, and I'm 9/10 a slob. I'm 9/10 flesh and weakness. I am 9/10 a buying sheep, not a roaring tiger. Most of the time, I'm the guy that's crying out into the maw of the storm, and I'm saying, God, where are you? My heart is full of sickness and fear. I'm the guy that's crouched over in the corner in a fetal position, scared to death. Now, Brad, Josh, Matt, Amy, John Ryer, can you love me in that? And I love how God's been teaching me that God is closest to us when the people of God dare to enter into our pain with us. Where they say, I will love you through this because you belong to me and I belong to you. And your story is my story. And until you have peace in your skin, I will not have peace in my skin. We are one, the same. I believe that there's some of you here who, and this was the image I saw. I saw an image of a great big black mouth. It's actually from Lord of the Flies, which I teach. But it's this. I saw this image of a great big mouth, and it was folding over you, and it was seeking you to swallow you down into darkness. And I just sense that today, the Lord wants to, one, save you from that mouth of darkness, but also through the body, that God wants to keep your mouth open from being shut by despair. So here's what I want to do. I just want to simply invite you just to stand where you are. And what we want to do is we just want to pray with you and just be with you in your pain. And we just want to open our mouths and pray for you. So Joel, if you'd kind of play over us. Let me just pray. And as I pray, if that's you, we just want to stand. That's a hard thing. It's a vulnerable thing. We just want to pray. We just want to pray. So right now, Holy Spirit, we just pray you come and you would minister to those who are in it, who are afraid of drowning, and whose mouths are being shut by the darkness. Wait.
If you guys want to close your eyes and kind of let these images play out on the movie screen in your mind, feel free to do that. Picture this with me. It's time for another festival in old Jewish culture. The place, we start in the town of Nazareth. The time, sometime in the last 400 years before Christ. It's a week before the festival begins in Jerusalem, but already many Jewish families have begun preparations for the journey. It is about 100 miles from start to finish along the Jordan River and the Jericho Road that lead to Jerusalem. And now our lens narrows on a particular family, Josiah, Rachel, and their little boy Nathaniel. It is the evening before they set out. The young couple has just put their 7-year-old boy to bed. The mother tiredly sits in a chair to rest a moment before packing the rest of the bread cakes, bedding, candles, oils, and other items that will take on the journey. The young father steps outside to throw a blanket over their mule that will bear their belongings with them to the holy city and converses briefly with a neighbor before going back inside. When he does, he finds Nathaniel out of bed, engaged in one more petition with his mother to let him stay behind this year. All the other kids will be there, and I never get to go. There will be lots of fun things to do and plenty of children to play with on the way to Grandma and Grandpa's house, his mother reminds him. Now it's time for bed. Go to sleep. The boy sniffles a little less as he climbs back in bed and falls asleep wondering what gifts his grandparents will have for him in Jerusalem. They always give the best toys. Morning comes early as a knock at the door wakens the young family. It is Josiah's older brother and his family. They stay the night at an inn after traveling already a day to Nazareth. After a good hearty breakfast with nearly 10 people crammed in their small one-room home, the family set out together on the familiar road. They are soon joined by other families making the journey and find themselves enveloped in a small gypsy-like community. But before they quite make it out of the town, Josiah and Rachel hear the cries of Nathaniel in the back of the group. Shortly before, several of Nathaniel's friends went running by, but not before noticing him. They stopped to ask if he was coming to the party. You see, every year at this time, one of their friends, whose father is very wealthy, throws a big birthday party for his son. Nathaniel has been invited every year and hears wonderful stories of the big party that lasts from midday till after dusk. There's always games to play, plenty of things to eat, and last year his friend got a pony that he let everyone take a turn to ride. Nathaniel's friends have been talking about this year's party for weeks. But Nathaniel's wealthy friend and the children gathered around him are not Jewish. They don't have to make the journey to Jerusalem 3 times a year and miss the big party as he does. So now, looking back at their son, seeing the other children running off in the distance, Rachel and Josiah see that Nathaniel has reached his limit. The tears are flowing, even though he's trying hard to be a big boy. Rachel looks at Josiah as if to say, "You're taking this one." But just as Josiah starts toward his son, another family passes by him, and one of their young boys is carrying something in his arms. He goes straight to Nathaniel to proudly present his new friend, a puppy. The puppy greets Nathaniel by licking his tears from his face. He even gets a few licks in the mouth, which quickly cause him to close his lips. And pretty soon the battle against tears becomes a battle against a smile that ends up in giggling and laughter. His friend puts the puppy down and it chases as he runs toward the other families. Nathaniel runs after them and soon forgets about the big party. Josiah turns to his older brother and says with a chuckle, "My little arrow." His brother slaps a firm hand on his back and, taking the cue, starts off in a loud voice, "Unless the Lord builds a house, the work of the builders is wasted." Others around him join in. "Unless the Lord protects a city, guarding it with sentries will do no good. It is useless for you to work so hard from early morning until late at night, anxiously working for food to eat, for God gives rest to his loved ones." Then, looking at Josiah with a smile, his brother continues the psalm. "Children are a gift from the Lord. They are a reward from him. Children born to a young man are like sharp arrows in a warrior's hands. How happy is the man whose quiver is full of them. He will not be put to shame when he confronts his accusers at the city gates." The small community carries on in this way. They continue to grow larger as they are joined by others making the journey. They stop in small towns and villages to stay the night in inns or with extended families or friends. And as they walk the uphill, rocky road to Jerusalem, they sing these psalms of ascent to one another along the way. One of them will start one off and the others will join in. At other times, it's mostly quiet. The sun can be quite hot at midday, and at night, things can be a little chilly. Nonetheless, they press on. They've been doing this for years now, and their parents and grandparents made these journeys as they are doing. They learn the psalms from them. They know them like we know songs from the radio. And as they sing them, a growing sense of expectation and awe for their God rises in their hearts. Verses like Psalm 126 that say, "When the Lord brought back his exiles to Zion, it was like a dream. We were filled with laughter. We sang for joy. And the other nations said, 'What amazing things the Lord has done for them.' Yes, the Lord has done amazing things for us. What joy." It is one of the times in the year that they come together to worship their God, the one true living God. And now as they come within 2 days of arriving in Jerusalem, the road becomes even more uphill and rocky. Josiah turns to his right to see a large, neatly placed pile of stones on one of the nearby hills. Then he notices a woman placing something on the pile before she kneels and then bows to it. It's not the first time at all Josiah has seen this. It's not even the first time he has seen this on his present journey. But something about this one catches his attention, and a memory flickers in his mind. It was over 8 years ago. He was in his early 20s. He and his wife had been married for 4 years, and Rachel still had not conceived a child. Josiah could hardly bear it anymore. He listened to his wife's quiet sobs at night. And as innocent as they seemed in the moment, his friend's remarks about, "When are you going to have a family?" stung his soul. He had no idea how many prayers he had offered up to God. Many of his Roman business partners had suggested time after time that maybe he should pray to other gods. Maybe they will hear your prayers. "Look," one would say, "I prayed to this or that god, and in no less than 3 weeks, my wife became pregnant." And another would say, "You must build an altar. one that is worthy, one that costs you, one that is visible to your God, that He may hear your prayers and answer them. And finally, one day, a very wealthy friend of Josiah's came to him, a friend that he had grown up with, and now they did some business with each other. "Josiah," he said, "I know you and Rachel have tried many years to make a family, and I know you are Jewish and believe in only one God and no other, but I have decided to do something for you. I am going to build an altar on your behalf to one of my gods. Remember the one I told you about, Josiah, the one that gave me my son? It wasn't until I built an altar that was costly to me that my prayers were answered. So, out of my wealth, I'm going to build a worthy altar for you that you may have a child." Josiah looked at his friend and pondered his offer. He was quiet for a moment. He knew in his heart that he could not accept this gift. He could not lose faith in his God, the God he knew to be the one true living God. But the idea, after 4 years of trying to make a family, had some appeal. Maybe it wouldn't hurt to just pray to one more God. And if it worked for his friend, why shouldn't it work for him? Josiah turned his gaze to the window and noticed the hills around Nazareth. Then he remembered one of the Psalms of Ascent that says, "Those who trust in the Lord are as secure as Mount Zion. They will not be defeated, but will endure forever. Just as the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people both now and forever." He turned to his friend, knowing both his answer and the fact that his answer could mean the end of their friendship. "You're a kind and very giving friend to me," he said, "but I cannot accept your offer. I must wait for the Lord my God to hear my prayers, and for him alone." And now, as Josiah looked at this woman bowing down to this pile of rocks on top of the hill, he remembered how God answered his prayer just a short time after that meeting 8 years ago. He looked at his son. Then he looked at his wife as she rode upon the donkey. She was pregnant again. It would be their second child. The 7 years as they tried to have another child between Nathaniel and this child were difficult, but not as difficult as those first 4 years. God was faithful. They knew he would be faithful again. Josiah said these words quietly to himself, "I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore." End of story. It's just a fictional story. I don't know if it actually happened, but I imagine, give or take some details, it's quite possible. Now, how does this compare to us today? Well, it didn't take us a week to get here, right? Most of us didn't walk, though some did. We probably just hopped in our cars and got here within 15 or 30 minutes. We didn't meet up with other families along the way and recite Psalms of Ascent to one another to prepare us for the morning. Nonetheless, here we are. We've gathered to worship a God with hearts of faith, with a unique time not only in our week, but in the monthly rhythm of this church to offer prayers and songs to our faithful God for a full 90 minutes. So I read you this story to give you a glimpse into your own heart, into the place in your heart where you can say, "Yes, God, I place my trust, my faith in you, and you alone." Now I want us to read one of these Psalms of Ascent together. It's Psalm 121. And as you do, let it be a prayer of faith from your heart that he cares for you, and that he will care for you in every step, in every season of your life. Would you guys stand now and read this with me? Psalm 121. "I look up to the mountains. Does my help come from there? My help comes from the Lord, who made the heavens and the earth. He will not let you stumble and fall. The one who watches over you will not sleep. Indeed, He who watches over Israel never tires and never sleeps. The Lord himself watches over you. The Lord stands beside you as your protective shade. The sun will not hurt you by day, nor the moon at night. The Lord keeps you from all evil and preserves your life. The Lord keeps watch over you as you come and go, both now and forever.